goes right. In motion, Jimmy Hunt right. Mock wants to throw. Fade pattern for Jimmy Hunt. Touchdown, Missouri. And the Tigers regain the lead.
Good morning. How's everybody doing today? I'm Brandon Kiley. She's Megan Armstrong. The show is The Morning Blitz, that play-by-play call brought to you by the Missouri Radio Network. Mizzou wins again. Do so in impressive fashion, 38-10 over UCF. Maddie Mock now the NCAA leader for touchdown passes this season. Pretty incredible. You've got two receivers, both in the top five nationally in touchdown receptions, plus two running backs that go for just about 100 yards. Once again, I'm starting to be really impressed with this team. I want to get your thoughts here in just a moment, Megan. Coming up here in about 10 minutes or so, Adrian Peterson, the story surrounding him has brought up a conversation that the NFL wants no part of. It seems like this is becoming a theme with the NFL. It's becoming a theme with us in the radio business to discuss these sorts of topics. I wanted to get into the line between discipline and abuse. It's something that I think is important. It's something that I've always struggled to understand, and we'll get into it coming up here in 10 minutes. And at 7:30, Field Yates, he's an NFL insider for ESPN. What are we supposed to make of the Adrian Peterson story? How do teams actually deal with these things? Because it seems like we're just kind of making up the rules as we go. And something a little lighter, the hell's Washington going to do about RG3? We'll get into all that with Field Yates coming up at 7:30. But Megan, I kind of hinted at it there. What are your thoughts on Mizzou? Because after this performance, I'm starting to become impressed. I'm starting to feel similar to the way that I felt about last year's team.
Yeah, I learned one important thing moving forward while watching the game on Saturday against UCF, and that is to not think, say, or feel anything about the Missouri football team until at least the third quarter.
Yep.
Because...
and like midway through the third
right.
quarter. Because their first possession in the third quarter never goes well.
Right. Because one thing I noticed is that, and I think that I've known this to be true, but I guess I'm just noticing it now because it's being put into action and actually been proven true, is that there's this depth on this Missouri football team that just wears the other teams down. I mean, they shut out UCF in the second half. What more proof do you need? So I don't know if that will be the case once they move into SEC play. Don't know, but it can't hurt. I mean, I think, and then also seeing Georgia lose to South Carolina, it's kind of like, all right, nobody is invincible. So that kind of heightened my view of Mizzou as well, because last week we were putting Georgia on this huge pedestal, and they were beaten. So
you mentioned depth, and you mentioned how it can wear people down. I keep remembering back to the Georgia game, the first year that Missouri was in the SEC, I believe 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And Mizzou was playing Georgia, and they were playing them tough for three quarters. And going into the fourth quarter, it seemed like Missouri had a legitimate shot to win this game. And it was the first SEC game that Mizzou had ever played. And then all of a sudden in the fourth quarter, Georgia just, they took it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the signs of the grown man football and everything that came with that. And it just kind of reminds you of, this is just a different team.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a different roster. It's a different construction to the roster than it was just 2 years ago, really. I mean, we look back to Media Day in 2012 when TJ Moe was standing up and saying, look, we're not afraid of the SEC. The only difference between the SEC and the Big 12 is in the Big 12, we put our athletes on offense. In the SEC, they put their athletes on defense. And I think we've kind of seen that transformation now mm-hmm. with the Mizzou roster is these linebackers are incredibly athletic.
Yeah.
Michael Scheer is a crazy person at middle linebacker. Kentrell Brothers, it's the same thing. Donovan Newsome, these guys run like 4.5, 4.6 40s, and they're all playing linebacker at Mizzou. That's not what we used to see.
No.
The corners are running 4.4s now. The safeties are 6'2", 220 pounds. Like, this is just not the same Mizzou roster that we're used to seeing. It looks like an SEC team. They play like an SEC team. And the difference is, this team has a really good quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought that Matty Mock could be good, but I thought it would take a while for him to gain this consistency. Last week was impressive. UCF has a really good cornerback. He was an all-conference player last year, potential to be even better this year. And Matty Mock just kind of picked on him. Matty Mock and Bud Sasser just went to town, and Mock didn't have as many yards as he did in the previous games, but he still finishes with four touchdowns, and as I said earlier, leading the NCAA in touchdowns now through 3 weeks of the season. I've been really impressed with the way that Matty Mock's played. And if he continues to play this way, if he continues to limit the mistakes, this team can go as far as he wants them to.
Mm-hmm. No, I believe that too. And I think he's very interesting to watch because he's this, I guess, combination of both volume and efficiency. Like, it just kind of like depends what he feels like doing on the given day. And I think the juxtaposition between UCF and the Toledo game is the perfect example of that. Toledo, didn't he throw for over like 400 yards? Like, the dude did not hold back. And last week he only had 144.
Yeah, 150 basically.
So, but at the same time, it kind of, he has around the same completion percentage. So, doesn't really, he's, I don't know, he's very interesting. The Andre Ware, I believe, was doing the play-by-play for SEC
Network. I know exactly where you're going with this.
I would not compare him to Johnny Manziel at all.
But he does some things that are similar.
But if you're drawing comparisons to Johnny Manziel, then hey, like, I'll take that. I think yeah, he's very athletic. He's athletic just like that. And he I will give Andre Ware credit. On that first drive, he did some Johnny Manziel-like thing, so it wasn't out of nowhere.
And the most Johnny Manziel-like thing that he does is when he's rolling to his left and he throws across his body and somehow, mm-hmm. he's done it twice now in the last 2 weeks, both of them touchdowns to Jimmy Hunt. And Bud Sasser actually was talking about how Maddie just scrambles and he finds this, he has this ability to find people open down the field. Talked about that yesterday at Media Day and what that means for a wide receiver.
That's what we really like about Maddie as receivers is, you know, if something seems to break down, don't give up on your route. Just, you know, make sure that you're still running around and trying to get open.
It's something that we've seen over and over and over again with Maddie Mock, and it's something that we didn't really see so much of with James Franklin. When the play would break down, he would break down. Yeah. And he would either get sacked or he would run for like a 3 yard gain. With Maddie, he's keeping his eyes down the field, which is something that's also impressed me for such a young quarterback. And he's making sure that he finds the open guy. And if that's a 5 yard pass, if that's a 25 yard pass, he finds it. Mm-hmm. And it's really impressed me, his maturation in such a young, for such a young player. I've really been impressed with what I've seen from Maddie Mock this year, especially after, and I came on the show and said it, I was worried about his consistency after those three scrimmages that I saw. It seems like maybe Maddie Mock's just a gamer. He goes out there and on Saturdays, he finds a way to make a play. And it's similar to what I don't believe that the Johnny Manziel comparisons are 100% accurate because they're so different in so many different ways that they play. But in that respect, in terms of they don't have the size, they don't look like they would have the arm. They don't play the typical way that you would expect a college quarterback to play. They're not true pocket passers, but they're not true runners, if that makes sense. They're just kind of creative. Hybrid. And they do things that you wouldn't expect them to do. And they're so different that it's really hard to prepare for. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't be more impressed right now with what I've seen from Maddie Mock. And I laughed at the Dark Horse Heisman things before the season. I mean, when you're number one in the nation in touchdown passes and you're playing as well as he has, and as you said earlier, with Georgia going down, with mm-hmm. South Carolina now 1-1 in the SEC, and Mizzou still having two games against Georgia and South Carolina, you've got a chance to win this thing again. And if Mizzou wins the SEC East, you've got a chance.
Yeah, and if we're talking about Heisman potential, the dude's entertaining. Like,
he's fun.
And that is a humongous component whenever it comes to Heisman. I mean, that might be the most important component just based on what we've seen the past couple of years. But you talked about athletes all over the Mizzou roster, especially on defense, and Shane Ray is the epitome of that, as well as Josh Acosta.
Yeah.
That interception was my favorite thing that happened the entire game.
And actually, Marcus Golden had some comments on this the other day. He's told us all offseason how Josh Acosta is a beast, and this was his reaction to him getting the interception and apparently wanting to play some tight end now.
Yeah, that's what he needed. If you don't get confidence after a play like that, you ain't going to never get confidence. And Josh a beast, man. He's a great kid, too. So you always want to see players like that happen to good people. And I'm glad it happened to him, but now he got to keep going and keep getting better every week.
And this is this is Marcus Golden on Josh Acosta wanting to play tight end.
Yeah, he be trying to get out there, but they're going to keep him at D-tackle. You know, we don't want to make him work too hard. We got to keep him ready for defense.
Did you know he played wide receiver in high school?
No.
Josh Acosta played wide receiver. Josh Acosta, for those that don't understand why this is funny, he's 6'5", 335 pounds, and he's built like a mountain. And that play that he made was not something you see a defensive tackle make, ever. He extended his arms, grabbed it at the highest point, and It was perfect. It was a perfect catch. I've never seen anything quite like it. It was incredible. And that was the turning point in the game. Mm-hmm. In the first three games of the year, we've seen that in every single game. The South Dakota State game, it was Marcus Murphy's return for a touchdown. Toledo last week, it was the forced fumble off of the interception when Bud Sasser hit it out and they punched it out. And instead of being a tie game 14-14, Mizzou goes up 21-7, and all of a sudden Mizzou's off to the races and they start crushing Toledo. And this week it was the interception. It's one play in every single game.
You mean that turnovers
yeah.
are playing a huge factor in Missouri's past 47 games.
Who would have thought? 47 straight games that they have a turnover now. It's incredible. And the team's on a really good run. They've got a game this week where they should blow out Indiana. And then you're in SEC. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to South Carolina with a chance to beat South Carolina. You've got a bye week in order to prepare for Georgia and get everybody healthy. And then you're going to Florida. And by October 12th, the day after Mizzou plays Georgia, we should know who's going to win the SEC East. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that at that point in the year, and it's up to Mizzou to take care of business, but at that point in the year, we should know. Yep. We should know if Mizzou can take the SEC East or not. And I at this point in time, I have no reason to believe that they can't.
I don't either. I mean, I'm with you. I think a lot of people thought that last year might be an anomaly, but maybe the way that they did it is an anomaly, but I think the result is I think they finally have that stability that hasn't been there for quite some time in the program in general.
I think so too. I think at this point in time, we can say Mizzou, along with South Carolina and Georgia, are the three best programs in the SEC. Mm-hmm. Not just three best teams for 2014 or for 2013, but these are the three best programs, and that's impressive. That's something Mizzou fans should really have a lot of pride in. Coming up next, it's been a hell of a week for the NFL. They're once again in the middle of a discussion that they want no part in. So what's going to happen next? We'll discuss it here on the Morning Blitz, KCOU, 88.1 FM and online, KCOU.fm.
With the exception of a few, the pictures of the child are not what's so horrifying. It's the testimony that I read in the police report from the child. The testimony of being worried he would be punched in the face, of saying he had been punched in the face in the past, of saying that he was afraid to talk.
That's Nick Wright. He had the exclusive story on this Adrian Peterson story. Huge props to him. I interned for him about a year ago. Huge props. Incredible reporting that he was able to do on this story. That was him on his show the other day explaining what he knew and what he understood about this story. In case you haven't heard, I don't know how you wouldn't at this point. Adrian Peterson has been indicted. He was processed, taken to jail, and released over the weekend. The Vikings made him inactive for Sunday's game, which prompted the Panthers to make Greg Hardy inactive for the game because of his domestic abuse problem as well. He's actually been found guilty of his. He's appealing, and that's why he's able to play as well. Adrian Peterson yesterday was reinstated. He's going to be able to play this weekend. And there was a company, a hotel that actually dropped or suspended their advertising.
Radisson.
Yeah, Radisson Hotel. They suspended their advertising with the Vikings yesterday because of this whole story. I guess first things first, Megan, and we're going to have Field Yates of ESPN, NFL Insider for ESPN, coming up here in just about 10 minutes or so. Overall thoughts on the story, first impressions, what was your reaction when you first heard the news about Adrian Peterson being indicted for, and I guess I should have said this, for allegedly taking a whooping too far and using a switch on his son and getting to the point where his son went home, went to the doctor's office, and they said, your son has been abused to his mother, and there are now charges being pressed. What were your initial reactions?
Well, there are so many more layers to this, believe it or not, than there were to the Ray Rice thing. I mentioned this to you last night.
I think part of that has to do with the Ray Rice thing.
Correct. I talked to you about this last night. I said that the foundation for this conversation very much depends on whose territory it's coming from, just based on connotation and how people grew up, whatever. We can get into that into a minute. Whereas with the Ray Rice stuff, that foundation was just unanimously cemented. Everybody knew that's wrong. You don't do that. Everybody, that I would trust knew that's wrong. You don't do that, whatever. But I was listening to Michael Smith and Jemele Hill's podcast, His and Hers, and he said something as a parent that I can't say because I'm not a parent. And he said, quote, "I know that as parents, our primary responsibility as it relates to our children is to get them to adulthood with as few scars as possible. Physical scars heal. It's the emotional scars, and those can last a lifetime," end quote. And I think for me, like I said, I've never been a parent, but I do have parents. And I think that those emotional scars and that fear is where it really comes from. Because like you said, whenever you're teasing this, whenever the show started, there's big difference between discipline and emotion, like fearing someone and having trauma. And I think with Adrian Peterson's four-year-old son, to say, like Nick Wright said in his testimony, that he's afraid to tell anybody about it because he doesn't want to be abused further. That's when you know it's too far. There's a difference between fearing discipline or punishment whenever you do something wrong. Like, that's the whole point of having timeouts in general. But if you fear more physical harm, or if you fear your parent hurting you in any way, that's the bold line for me that you don't cross. And I think there's there's a ton of evidence to back it up that he just went way too far.
And the thing that is scary to me is there's a very slim chance that Adrian Peterson is actually found guilty of this.
Oh.
Because where he's being indicted and where he's going to go to court, this is kind of the norm. This is a country part of Texas. And from what I've heard, from what I've listened to, from what I've read in the South, this is just something that happens. This is just something that people seem to grow up with. And I'll be honest, before Friday, I wasn't aware of what a switch was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that this happened. And the details of Adrian Peterson going out to the back and grabbing a branch and cutting it off, taking off the leaves, sticking them in his son's mouth, allegedly, making his son drop his pants and hitting him repeatedly, allegedly about 15 times. And then putting that together with the stories that I've heard of Adrian Peterson being the guy that he shakes your hand and your hand hurts after mm-hmm. he shakes your hand because of how strong he is. And knowing that he runs more violently in a violent sport. Like he runs to a different level. Like he's stronger than very strong men. Mm-hmm. And then putting this all together and this idea that he is disciplining his child, it just gets lost with me. It's no longer discipline at this point. It's now, it's gone too far to the point where, are you disciplining him, or are you kind of getting some enjoyment out of this and appreciating, and like, this is just something different entirely. It's discipline's been lost.
Yeah.
Discipline was way out the door before you got to this point. And it's scary. Like, it's scary to me, and it made me sick to my stomach to see that this happens. Like, it just opens your eyes, similar to the Ray Rice situation, where we all know domestic abuse happens every day. We all know that it's a huge problem. But until you see that video, that puts something with domestic abuse that you actually understand. Like, that's mm-hmm. tangible. That's real. And it kind of, it brings it into the forefront. And you're like, holy crap. Like, I knew it was bad. I knew that this was a terrible thing. I knew that a guy hitting a girl could result in that. But then you see it and you're like, oh my God, that's so much worse than I ever could have imagined. It's the same thing with the Adrian Peterson story.
There's a major difference between being aware intellectually of the statistics and emotionally knowing one person's story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's what it takes for people to understand it, as sad as it is. And for me, my aunt is actually a social worker and child trauma specialist, and we were going to have her on the show, but she just didn't. but I can speak for her in the fact that whatever she is allowed to tell me under confidentiality clauses, which isn't much, but I can tell that there are cases like this. Like, I can't even tell you how many cases she deals with on a day-to-day basis. I don't know how she does it. And like Michael Smith was saying, and what I agree with, is that it's those emotional things. And those pictures of Adrian Peterson's son with his cuts a week later is, like you said, that once you see it, that's just startling and it hurts your heart and all that stuff. But what's most concerning to me is, what does that kid feel like? Like, we don't know. And it's just so sad because so many mental health problems, so many behavioral problems stem from childhood traumas. So many of them. And whether it's intentional or not, whether Adrian Peterson was malice or not, he did it. And the kid's 4 years old. He doesn't know if his dad was malice. Like, he doesn't even know what malice is. He just knows his dad hit him and hurt him. So, I don't know. It's worrisome to me. And I think that I don't know if everybody did, but I read Adrian Peterson's statement yesterday, and he said that he's been meeting with psychologists and figuring out, you know, better ways to parent and all this stuff. And I hope that he really is. And I hope that he continues to, because I think that that's a very, very important component to it.
And I want to get into what the line is between discipline and abuse. I want to do that at 7:45. We're going to talk to Field Yates here in just a couple minutes. I look at this story and I see what's happened, and I see that it's such a big name, and I see that it brings prominence to a discussion that we're all very uncomfortable having. And the NFL is even more uncomfortable being the center point of the discussion. And I think it's good. I'm glad that we're able to have this discussion, and I'm glad that we're able to have a discussion that on a normal basis without sports, we wouldn't be having, we wouldn't be interested in having it. And I'll be honest, felt a little uncomfortable on Friday when I saw how many people were having the discussion with personal experiences. It wasn't a discussion about something that was a third person thing, like with sports. It was, I've had this, I've experienced this. This is my own thoughts. This is based on my experiences, and it's real. It's tangible for me. I couldn't offer that perspective, but I can offer a perspective. I hope on what my thoughts are on this line between discipline and abuse. We'll get into that at 7:45. But coming up next, what's the NFL going to do about this? And what are we to make of the last week in the NFL? We'll discuss it all next with Field Yates of ESPN. He's an ESPN NFL insider. That's next on the Morning Blitz, KCOU 88.1 FM, and online at KCOU.FM. And welcome back. It is the Morning Blitz here on KCOU 88.1 FM and online at KCOU.FM. Coming up here in about 10 minutes or so, we'll get back into the Adrian Peterson story. We're going to discuss it a little bit here, though, with our pal Field Yates. He's at Field Yates on Twitter. He is an NFL insider for ESPN. Before we get into anything else, Field, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well, my friend. Good to be rock and rolling the season. Good to have some rhythm, and good to have some football to watch.
It is good to have some football back. One guy that wasn't on the field this weekend was Adrian Peterson. What do you make of this entire story? What do you make of the last week in the NFL as well?
Yeah, sad, disappointing. Find other words that have sort of a negative connotation, because I haven't been around as long as many of the seasoned reporters who have shared this sentiment. But for my money, this was the most haunting week in NFL history that I've been a part of in terms of off-field transgressions. It just was, there's simply no excuse for it. It's despicable and deplorable, and it's a black cloud hanging over the league that so many people love.
What can the NFL do to make sure that this is a true cultural shift and not just some fad that they're trying to run away from?
That's a great question. You know, it's one of those that people want to come up with a hard and fast take on how we can remedy this situation by the time that week three football kicks off, which by my count is at, just about, not even, just over 48 hours. So 60 hours before we kick off week four football. But the problem is that this is a really a development of infrastructure, a raising of awareness for players on these issues, and coaches and owners and executives and anybody who is guilty, who is potentially culpable for such actions. I think it's just a continued dedication to it. If there really was an easy answer, I think the NFL will be implementing it here soon. But it's going to be a steady, slow, potentially long process that the NFL is going to have to work extremely hard towards.
And once again, we're talking to our guy Field Yates. He's at Field Yates on Twitter. He's an NFL insider for ESPN. One of the things that's really caught my eye in this whole thing is it seems like we're kind of just making up policies and making up rules as we go. Last week, you had Greg Hardy and Adrian Peterson both deactivated. This week, it looks like both of them will be active for their respective teams. Is there any rhyme or reason as to why we're making these policies, or are we truly just kind of by the whims of our seat and we're just going?
Well, I think it's probably reactionary, right? If you look at how these situations have been handled, both of those players, obviously with Greg Hardy, he was active week one, and then given the backlash that I'm sure the Panthers felt over the past week leading up to week two, they decided to act differently. But I think at the end of the day, I'm less concerned about the impetus for some of these decisions, whether or not they're reactionary, whether or not they're from the team's own good heart. To me, at the end of the day, it's about doing the right thing. just like when the NFL instituted its new domestic violence policy. People said, well, that's just a reaction to Ray Rice. Well, my retort was, would you rather them have the previous policy that basically was no policy, or would you rather them carry a swift and strong act that says that any player who has a domestic violence incident is automatically suspended for 6 games, and if he has a second one, he's kicked out of the league for life. Whether or not these things are done in reaction, in just because of public outcry or not, it's all about doing the right thing. I think it needs to be the trend the NFL must follow going forward.
What are you sensing is the feeling internally across the NFL?
Embarrassment, dismay. The situation is probably, how did we get here? You know, where do we go next? I mean, listen, the bottom line is the NFL is in the height of its calendar right now. We are in 2 weeks into the regular season, which is it feels long when we're in it, but it feels short when we're not in the regular season or even the postseason. The NFL dominates the news cycle close to 365 days a year, but for, you know, the 180 or so days that there are actually games being played, the news is dominated by on-field situations. Hey, should they have gone for it on fourth down last night? Were the Eagles so smart for trading for Darren Sproles? It sure looks like it. Things of that nature. During the offseason, it's the draft. It's free agency. But unfortunately, throughout this year, and this dates back to the start of this offseason, the biggest headlines in the NFL have not been about free agent signings and trades and draft picks and all that. It has been about player conduct off the field.
Field Yates of ESPN NFL Insider for ESPN joining us now. It's interesting to me that the Vikings, like Brandon said, deactivated Adrian Peterson last week as well as Brett Hardy with the Panthers, but yet Ray McDonald played for the 49ers. What incentive do the 49ers have to do the right thing if they, I mean, granted there's public backlash, but I mean, there's not really a tangible effect on them for continuing to play Ray McDonald.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I think that, you know, Brandon asked, like, is there sort of a rhyme or reason to why these things are taking place? And my answer was, I think you do the right thing. In this case, I think the right thing is for the 49ers to fit Ray McDonald. That being said, we have more evidence for the Adrian Peterson situation. There's pictures, there's text messages that have been made public that sort of guideline us as to what took place with Adrian Peterson and one of his children. And Ray McDonald, I think there's still a lot of uncertainty as to what exactly took place. The 49ers, I would imagine, are abreast of the details of the situation, and in that case, they felt comfortable, given what they know, do not need to deactivate Ray McDonald. At the end of the day, though, I still think that it's okay. I would have no problem if the team told me, hey, we are still gathering more information. With that in mind, it's time to sit this player.
And once again, we're speaking with Field Yates of ESPN, an NFL insider for ESPN. You hear yesterday that there's a hotel that pulled out their advertising, or at least suspended their advertising with the Vikings. And we hear all of these off-the-field stories, whether it's Adrian Peterson or Ray Rice or Ray McDonald or Greg Hardy, and we've been talking about them all for weeks on end now. Do you think this has had an impact on people watching football, people being able to enjoy the sport? Or is it, I guess, part two, is it the flags that are going to have more of an impact on people watching the game and enjoying the game for what it is?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen the ratings. My guess is it probably hasn't impacted ratings very much, at least in a negative way. If I understand correctly, I think the ratings for the Thursday night game were actually outstanding, that Baltimore-Pittsburgh game. And, of course, you have one of the teams that's come under fire in Baltimore. And then, you know, at the heated rivalry as it is, it was broadcast on a major network and CBS. You know, so the ratings, I don't think, are going to dip by any stretch because of the situations on the field. I think that, if anything, it's going to have people feeling a certain way. But with so much interest in the games themselves, so much interest in the world of fantasy football, I would imagine that we will continue to see fans come out in droves to stadiums and fans pile up on Sunday and watch their games in front of their big screens as they have in many previous seasons.
Given our first few questions, you would think that we're talking with Brian Williams and not Field Yates, but we are talking to Field Yates, the NFL insider for ESPN, and we will ask you some quick-hitting football questions right now, beginning with RG3 and what in the world Washington is going to do.
Yeah, I think it is one. You have to at least plan on Kirk Cousins playing for an extended period of time. And I know there's been some optimism about Robert Griffin III potentially returning in 4 to 5 weeks, but this is a dislocated ankle. And I think when you look at Robert Griffin III, you look at the way that he's built, and he's continued to have these lower body injuries. And I know there's some fluke factor to it, but with the guy who's got a narrower build and obviously a certain style as a runner that has left him susceptible to big hits. And I know this is a non-contact injury in this case. I think the Redskins have to be prudent in terms of planning ahead and possibly be looking at a future that includes Kirk Cousins as a starter, not necessarily Robert Griffin III. Is that to say that I think that Robert Griffin III won't be the starter? No, but I think they understand, given how much time he has missed, they have to at least have a contingency plan in place, which is sort of the reason why they drafted Kirk Cousins and why they've rebuffed trade offers for Kirk Cousins during various offseasons.
Just a few minutes left here with Field Yates of ESPN. So we've got Philadelphia, we've got Carolina, Arizona, and then Buffalo, Cincinnati, Houston, and Denver. Those are our 2-0 teams right now. Which one to you is the most surprising?
I'd say most surprising probably has to be Buffalo. I think that Houston, you look at the teams that they've played, and I don't know if they necessarily have beat anybody of consequence, but nonetheless, still an impressive effort. I think Buffalo, and then I also think that Carolina has to be in there, not because I think they would be good, but all offseason, didn't we hear about the potential regression for the Carolina Panthers? And it may well come. It could come, I should say. But I know that internally, and you heard it, people around Charlotte, they felt as though the Carolina Panthers were built to once again succeed in 2014, despite sort of the national sentiment they had no chance. Those two teams, the Buffalo Bills, Carolina Panthers, continue to impress. The Bills beating the Bears on the road in week one, and then taking care of business and really flattening a Miami team that in week one flattened the Patriots.
So we talked about the 2-0 teams. Who's the most perplexing 1-1 team to you? Who are you the most surprised, or you just don't understand where they are right now? Whether it's San Francisco, I don't really know what I'm getting at this point with them. Or is it Atlanta, where you just don't know? Who's the one that you look at and you say, I don't know what to expect the rest of the year? They could be great. They could be bad.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I would say maybe a team like the Pittsburgh Steelers, Baltimore Ravens, you know, those two teams, the AFC North, they squared off, obviously, last week. You know, those would be two teams that you say to yourself, hey, you know, it's hard because our sample size is still small. The Steelers basically hung on against the Browns, but they still got to win. They could be a 6 or 8 win team this year. But I also think, given sort of the quarterback, the track record of success, they haven't had a losing season in so freaking long. It's unbelievable. The Steelers could be one of those teams that kind of sneaks into the back door of the playoffs. You know, I still think if there's a team that I'm a little bit curious about, and this isn't a 1-1 team, but the Bengals at 2-0, not to discredit what they've done, but they're now dealing with the possibility of being without A.J. Green for a little bit of time. And then, listen, Andy Dalton, there's sort of a I'll believe it when I see it factor in terms of him and clutch production, especially in the postseason. He's been very good so far. The Bengals have been incredibly tough on defense. Their offensive line has played better than any other in the NFL right now. But I'm looking forward to seeing more and more from the Bengals as the season progresses.
As you watch Houston, is this a good team, or is this a team that, as you said earlier, is just taking advantage of a really, really easy schedule, kind of like Kansas City did last year?
I don't think it necessarily has to be one or the other. I think this is a team that, if you look at their upcoming schedule, they've got the Giants on the road and the Bills at home. You know, the Giants on the road, who knows what to make of that game, but I could at least see them winning, you know, against New York, a team that sort of really stumbled out of the gate. But I think with Houston, they do a few things well, and I think sometimes we forget, and I'll use that Kansas City team from last year as an example. You know, in order to go from bottom of your division to average, or in the case of Kansas City last year, well above average, you don't have to go from a terrible quarterback to a superstar quarterback. Alex Smith is a very good quarterback. Is he a top 5 or 8 quarterback? Probably not. But if you look at a player like Ryan Fitzpatrick, he doesn't have to be great for the Texans to succeed this year. He has to just be average. That's sort of, you know, the vertical ascension of the NFL doesn't always have to come with just an elite quarterback. So the Texans, they've been running the ball incredibly effectively. Arian Foster looks sort of like what we're accustomed to seeing Arian Foster look like in previous seasons, not last year notwithstanding. They've got a good front seven, and I think they've got some active playmakers in the secondary. J.J. Swearinger, he's a player that sort of attracted more attention for the things he said not necessarily the things he did on the football field, but all of a sudden he's becoming a nice young safety. So I think the Texans are a team that could, I could see them holding on, and, you know, 8 wins does not seem out of the question for a team that lost 14 straight games to end 2014.
Last question here for Field Yates, NFL Insider for ESPN, and it has to do with the Chiefs. We have to mention them, even though sometimes it's a little painful around here. But what did you make of the Chiefs' Week 2 loss to the Broncos? I'm sure, from my perspective, it said a lot more about the Broncos than it did the Chiefs, because personally, I expect the Chiefs to be well below 500 this year.
Yeah, you know, there's no moral victories in football, I just say at least, right? But I actually thought the Chiefs showed, you know, some resilience and some toughness in that game. Now, the schedule is just really difficult. You know, that's the thing. I think this Week 3 game is going to be a particularly interesting one, because they go to Miami, a team, it's going to be hot down there, but, you know, as you guys know, in Missouri, as I spent some time up there myself, I know the summers are unforgiving in terms of weather. So the fact that weather factor probably isn't as stringent as the other teams. But, you know, the Chiefs, that week, that win, you know, that to be able to contain the Broncos, I think what we saw, there's maybe not a perfect blueprint for beating the Broncos, except for the one they had up in Seattle. But if you can sustain drives and convert third downs, that was something that San Diego did last year when they beat the Broncos in their late season game. That's one of the really strong elements, being able to defeat Denver. Kansas City showed that last week. And then, you know, Denver's red zone offense, I'd have to look at the numbers. I just, from what I've seen, I don't think it's been quite as effective as it was last season. I think those are the two areas where the Chiefs were able to kind of neutralize Denver. So, listen, it's a loss. I don't think the Chiefs are sitting there smiling. At the same time, to play within 7 points of Denver is, you know, in some ways a sign of encouragement.
He's Field Yates. He's at Field Yates on Twitter. He is the NFL insider for ESPN. We always appreciate his time here on the Morning Blitz. Field, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Thank you.
You bet, guys.
Once again, he's Field Yates from ESPN. He's their NFL insider. He's on the show, NFL Insiders. he's always great, and he always makes me think. And the way that he and the rest of ESPN has been able to really give their legitimate and honest thoughts on all these stories, I think has been really impressive from ESPN. The reaction from Adam Schefter immediately when the news came out, I thought was one of the more honest and sobering moments on television that I've seen in a long time. Because I've never seen him that mad mm-hmm. on live TV.
I'll definitely throw in Hannah Storm.
I actually haven't seen that yet.
You haven't?
But I heard it was good.
She was visibly on the edge of tears. It was sad, but it was wonderful at the same time.
Coming up next, we're going to get back into this. I want to get back into the discipline discussion, because there is a line here, and I just don't understand where it is at this point. We'll try and hash it out next on the Morning Blitz, KCOU 88.1 FM and online, KCOU.fm. Feel like your match, your burning sun. I'll be the bright and black that's making you run. Huge thanks to Field Yates for joining us just a little bit ago. The podcast of that, excuse me, will be up here shortly on themorningblitz.podomatic.com. So we got into this a little bit earlier, Megan, and this whole Adrian Peterson story has brought up a discussion about discipline and where the line is between discipline and abuse. And I don't so much want to talk about Adrian Peterson here, although he is kind of the culprit for the discussion, but I want to discuss the actual line between discipline and abuse, because I think it's an interesting conversation. I think it's something that I never really thought about before, and this brought it into my perspective. It brought it into the national perspective of people in general. But I'll be honest, whenever I was a kid, wasn't really spanked. It just wasn't something that my parents did. Didn't really have a father that was around, so my mother just didn't do it. It just wasn't something that I used. And to discipline me, instead of her saying, or like her getting out a paddle or her getting out a switch or her getting out of belts or anything, it was, "I'm disappointed in you, go to your room, and I'll talk to you in 10 minutes. And it works, because at that point I knew, like, oh crap, she's super mad. Like, she is super angry. I did something, I messed up. And I think that's really what it all comes down to is, does the kid know that he's messed up? If the kid knows that he's in the wrong, it doesn't take hitting you with a switch to do that. It takes finding a way to get to that kid, to find how you can discipline each individual case, because each individual kid is going to be different in how they respond to discipline, how they respond to different things. But I don't understand how we could ever get to the point where the only option, the way that we discipline people in general, is by hitting them. I can't wrap my mind around that. I can't wrap my mind around the idea that that is how we are supposed to discipline our kids. I can't get behind that.
No. My dad only spanked me once and he felt so guilty afterward that I think it affected him more than it affected me. Needless to say, he never did it again. So, like you, I remember whenever I would get in trouble, my punishment was typically having to buy a spiral notebook and having to fill the whole notebook with the same sentence, like, I'm sorry I lied, or I'm sorry I did whatever, and it definitely worked. So getting back to the whole discipline versus abuse thing, which it's so hard to say, okay, this is the line, because I think that it varies very much differently from case to case, even though I think it's very clear whenever abuse is abuse. So it's difficult for me, especially having never been a parent, to say how to parent children. Although I will say that whenever I do have children, long, long, long time from now, I will not physically discipline them because I don't think I will feel comfortable doing so. Because I don't want to hurt them. even if it's not considered abuse, I don't want to hurt them. I don't want them to be that kind of afraid of me. So I don't even want to tread that line or whatever line it is. I don't feel comfortable with it.
And here's my question is like, and I know this is going to sound odd, and that's kind of the point of the question. And it's a false basis because of, I guess here's the question. If Ray Rice told you that whenever he was in the elevator, he was disciplining his wife because she had done something wrong and that was his discipline for her, we would say that's unacceptable. Like that's an unacceptable way to discipline your wife, because what the hell are you doing?
Right.
Like, what are you doing that? But for some reason in this country, we have decided that the only people that it is okay to hit and to discipline them or to make a point to them is kids.
The most defenseless population.
Exactly. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, if Megan was super angry at me and was, like, getting all up in my face and was calling me names and was telling me that I'm terrible at this and was talking about my mother, talking about my girlfriend, and just wouldn't stop, and all of a sudden started pushing me, and it got to the point where my only defense was that I had to hit her, I'd be going to jail. Like, it would be abuse. And yeah. Yet if Megan was my daughter and she did something wrong and I wanted to take a belt and to whip her, I would be able to under this premise of I'm disciplining my child. And I just don't understand it. I don't understand why we draw this line of, okay, it's okay to do this, it's not okay to do this. Where's the line? Where does it become gray area? And especially with this Adrian Peterson story, I see so many people that say, I grew up this way. This is what I grew up with. This is how I'm going to discipline my kids as well, because I believe it's important. We grew up with a lot of different things. We grew up in a lot of different eras. We all grew up differently. If you take everything from your childhood and you implement that in your kid's childhood, to be honest with you, you just can't do it. Mm-hmm. Like, times have changed, and we have evolved as a country, and we have evolved as a society to the point where it's not okay anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, some of the stuff that happened in your childhood, like it or not, it's not okay. It doesn't work anymore.
I think the gray area is simply that there isn't a universal truth, because there are people that are very successful that were spanked and say that it worked for them. And there are also people in jail who were spanked. Like, you know, it's just I think it has to do with parenting as a whole. I don't think it just has to do with disciplinary reasons. And so it's very difficult for any of us to look in on this Adrian Peterson situation and be like, OK, what kind of parent is he? We don't know. He has frankly admitted, this is what I knew. I am acknowledging just now that I'm wrong. I didn't know that I was
wrong. I don't think he acknowledges that he's wrong.
He's acknowledging that he should learn other ways,
yeah.
Whatever. But he didn't know that he was wrong. So, but the rest of us are like, okay, dude, you just like really hurt your child.
But there's a lot of people that aren't. That's what's the most like saddening to me is there's a lot of people that are just saying, look, what he did isn't wrong. What he did is fine.
Yeah.
What he did is what I would do to my kids. And that's what's troubling to me is that there's so many people out there that see it the same way as Adrian Peterson, that there are so many kids that are growing up today that are growing up in these kinds of conditions. That's terrifying to me.
Yeah. No, it is. And I like I said or mentioned a couple minutes ago, that the children are the most helpless population that there is. So they can't defend themselves because that would only lead to more physical harm. So I don't know what the answer is, other than the fact that I personally am never going to physically discipline, quote unquote, my children. I mean, as far as Adrian Peterson goes, I think it's very obvious that he took it too far. And I think that the only answer would be for, I guess, someone, hopefully the mothers of these children, to hold him accountable to not do that anymore. I don't know how you would do that. But I don't know. I mean, that's the sad part, I guess, is that we are completely helpless in that. I mean, there's nothing we can do for that. Those, I guess, 2 4-year-old kids or however many children he has.
I just don't know how we change this perspective. Like, I don't know, how do we get to the point where we all agree that this is not okay?
I don't think we do.
I just can't imagine. Like, I know. I mean,
I agree with you. I just don't think that.
I know. And I'm not saying that you're wrong, because I think you're right. It's just scary to me that we're at this place and there are so many people on one side and then there are so many people on the other side, and there's really no, there's no common ground. Mm-hmm. There's no common element where we can come to an agreement and say, okay, let's compromise. Let's go there.
Yeah.
Like, because there's just not, like, there's just people that this is their culture. This is their background. This is what they believe in. This is their belief system. And it's scary.
I suppose the only common ground would be that each side truly believes they're doing, well,
they're doing it correctly.
They're doing the best thing for their child.
Yeah.
Unless they're just abusing, I mean, there are obviously those extreme cases where they're abusing their children just to abuse their children. But I think as far as Adrian Peterson is concerned, I think he falls in the air of, I believe that this is what's right for my sons.
And I think that's maybe, and maybe this is the wrong word, but the most interesting aspects to this case is Adrian Peterson believes he's a good father. Adrian Peterson is, he has 6 children. I don't know how many different women, but at least 2 that we know of. Mm-hmm. And he's allegedly or supposedly is active and involved in all of their lives. He comes around plenty, and he based on the knowledge that we know, he's a good father outside of, and maybe even including, depending on your belief point, what he's done. Mm-hmm. And there are some people that would say, like, look, if he's a great father and he's doing this, he's doing everything right. I don't fall under that viewpoint, but I just don't know how to rationalize or to wrap my head around or to get around the fact that this happened, but he seems to love his kids and he seems to really want the best for his kids and he seems to want them to grow up to be successful and to help them through this. But doing it through this path, it doesn't coincide. I'm having a really tough time wrapping my mind around all these different facets of the situation. I can't.
Just ignorance.
Yeah.
Whether it's malicious ignorance or just he simply does not know that there's other ways to do this because of the way he was raised. That's just what it is. He's ignorant. He doesn't know. And that's definitely not to condone what he did, because I don't at all. I just, like I said, I hope that for the kids' sake, something changes, because that's what all that matters. I don't care about Adrian. I mean, it's the kids. They're 4 years old. Yeah. Like,
and that's the other thing. What the hell could have happened? And allegedly, the kid was on one of those, I don't know if you remember him from the arcade, but like the motorcycles, yeah, where like it kind of moves back, yeah, and forth, and you're just on the automated game. He was on one of those. He pushed his brother off, and that's what deserved, according to Adrian Peterson, this lashing by Adrian Peterson. It's scary stuff, and I don't know how that can deserve this, and the pictures are jarring, and the situation in and of itself is shocking, and it's disappointing, and it's a story that we're going to keep talking about here on the Morning Blitz, and a story that we're going to keep following as it develops. And yesterday, there was another story where Adrian Peterson supposedly uses this with all of his children, mm-hmm, and there's another alleged investigation into Adrian Peterson for possible child abuse, and It shouldn't come as much of a surprise based on the comments that we've heard from Adrian.
It does come as a surprise, considering that his 2-year-old son died last year of child abuse.
It's a surprise based on that, but from what we've known from the last week, shouldn't come as a surprise at this point.
Why would one kid be different than
the other? This is just how he disciplines his kids, and that's how he believes that they should be growing up. And I just don't know how to justify that with, based on what we know about him as a father. It's all very confusing to me, and I just don't know where that line is anymore between discipline and abuse. I don't know where we look. She's Megan Armstrong. I'm Brandon Kiley. Once again, a huge thanks to Field Yates for joining us today. I'll be back same time, same place tomorrow here, 7 to 8 a.m. on KCOU 88.1 FM and KCOU.fm.